Movie buff specialist Phil and John are back with episode number 17. I forgot to actually look at that. I should have done that. We're number 84 in our top 100 movies of all time. We're going to be talking Trainspotting tonight. That is John's movie. And for me, we're going to be talking Delicatessen, because my actual number 17, or my number 84, sorry, is 7, which is way higher on John's list because he does have a bit of a Fincher love. So we'll be talking about that at a later time. But we'll be talking about Delicatessen instead, Jean-Pierre Jeunet's first feature-length film. And I actually think it goes really well with Trainspotting, both kind of lighthearted looks at really dark subjects. I guess you call them lighthearted as you could probably possibly be about such subjects. But I had not seen Trainspotting in about a decade. It certainly stood up. I remember not loving it the first time I watched it, but I really, really appreciated it this time. John, first time seeing Delicatessen, right?
Yes. First time hearing about the movie. But ooh, it was a ride.
Yeah. That it's going to be fun to talk about. And we'll definitely lead with that one and get into Trainspotting, which people actually want to hear about. So you'll have to wait. But Delicatessen is one of those movies when Netflix first came out and everybody was like, ooh, Blockbuster's going to die. And I was a huge Blockbuster guy. I would be at Blockbuster every week. All the movies I own are essentially like 3 for $20 from Blockbuster. Mm-hmm. You know, they used to have the bin when they would get tired of them. But anyway, so then Netflix comes along and you could make a list of like movies, you know, your watch list, all this stuff. Delicatessen was on my watch list, the original Netflix watch list I'd ever made. I hadn't even watched Amelie yet, or I just heard about Amelie and said, oh, I'll put Delicatessen. I put City of Lost Children. It took me 11 years to finally watch this friggin' movie. 11 years, John. And then I ended up watching City of Lost Children the next day. 11 years. And then in 2 days, I watched both of these movies. But I'm a huge Jeunet fan. So I'd heard about it, but had just kept putting it off. And I think because it's a relatively unseen movie, I just never really had the motivation. Whereas if it was something like Trainspotting, you'd say, okay, I'm going to go out of my way to watch this because everybody's heard of that. And a lot of people discuss it.
Yeah, definitely. And that's one of these things, especially when we get into like European cinema and stuff, that we kind of do push it off a bit. There are a lot of times where I'll be like, I have this foreign movie on the top of my list. And it's just like, I don't really feel like watching a movie with subtitles right now. And I push it off and I forget about it for a long time. And then I come back to it afterwards and be like, why did I put this off for so long?
And that's Tokyo Story for me right now. I haven't watched Tokyo Story yet, but everybody always tells me that Tokyo Story is the greatest foreign film ever made. Could arguably be the best movie ever made. And I always say, I'm going to watch it. And then it's always subtitled and it's 2.5 hours long. And I'm like, okay, that's one of those movies I really want to be in the right mood for. And then after I saw Amelie and after I saw Very Long Engagement, which are both movies on my list, I said to myself, well, when I watch Delicatessen, I want to appreciate the hell out of this. But then for some reason, it just kept getting pushed back and back and back and back. And what's funny is you watched it for your first time now because I told you to. Friend of mine who also created his top 100 list, he just watched Delicatessen for the first time. And the reviews have been unanimous thus far. And all of us have agreed this is a 4-star movie and that it is just so delightfully bizarre. So, Delicatessen. I chose this and then I'll let you rebut here or whatever the word is, rebut. But I chose Delicatessen alongside 7 because after I watched it, I said to myself, this gives me a 7 feel. It's not as dark as 7. It's obviously not as gross as 7, but there are still some pretty messed up moments. And I felt like it was a good kind of not contrast, but how you can have a really dark, somber movie. Like 7 to me almost feels post-apocalyptic, even though it's taking place in current day. But Delicatessen, it is post-apocalyptic, and it's just this grimy, nasty, what kind of situation is this, but told in a completely different tone, like only Jeunet could do. So that's why I ultimately ended up going Delicatessen. I felt like it was a good movie that kind of gets into what 7 is about in some way, but without having a mystery or anything like that, and instead being more about just freaking weirdness. But John, I'd like to hear your thoughts since this is the first time you'd watched it.
I found that this movie really kind of falls in line with a lot of like the dystopian fiction, science fiction of that time frame, like that decade around 91. So like going back to like 85 up to 95, looking at like the films of Terry Gilliam in the time. Mm-hmm. So like 12 Monkeys in Brazil have very similar tones to this movie at times. There's a Russian film, Kinzaza, which has very similar tones to this. And it really is just this fantastic clipping of this time frame where theater or film was getting a little more experimental again. Directors were being a little more edgier with the way they were approaching things. We have a lot of those like quick takes onto different people's faces to see their responses to things in this movie. And it really reinvigorated film, I think, because especially coming off the 80s, where we've talked previously about how the 80s wasn't a great decade for film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the 80s flat out sucks. I mean, we talk about that all the time. There's really not much to pull from the 80s. We don't have very many movies on our list from the 80s. And I think that's like a general consensus. If you were to ask people to start listing off best picture winners, even most people could name the 90s. They could name the 2000s. They could probably name the all of the 70s. If you can't name a 70s best picture winner, it's just because you haven't seen The Sting or Patton. But this is really the worst decade for best picture winners, aside from probably the 30s, because the 30s have some, you know, really bad movies in there. But also it's the times, and it's just, you know, now we're almost 100 years later, so it makes sense. But I agree with you. A movie like Brazil, I feel like the reason it hit cult classic status is because it's so friggin' weird and it's so much different from what else was coming out at that time. You know, you think about I Have Who Framed Roger Rabbit, which we'll be talking about actually in a couple weeks. It's not too far up from here. I think only three more weeks. A movie like Who Framed Roger Rabbit is just so bizarre. And people were kind of looking for the bizarre around this time. That's why Terry Gilliam worked. Janae can't get a movie made nowadays because he's too weird for audiences now. Audiences nowadays, they want the more realistic. They want the more train spotting. They want the more Requiem for a Dream. And even though those movies were way ahead of their time, that's what they want. They want that movie that says, ooh, those are real people doing real stuff, and that's how I want to watch it. Back in the late 80s, early 90s, we wanted the bizarre. We wanted something that was going to bring us out of this funk of, do I need to watch Chariots of Fire, Gandhi, Out of Africa? No offense to Amadeus, because it's a great movie, and I know it's on your list, but those are all movies that are winning Best Picture. They're all biopics. They're all biopics. And biopics or biopics, choose one. I know. Well, that's New Jersey for you. But when you start really breaking this down, you say to yourself, okay, how do we get out of that funk? Well, the way you get out of that funk is to start making weird movies. And an auteur like Genet and Mark Caro, who also was his partner until they got to Alien Resurrection, this was their time to shine. And if you haven't seen The City of Lost Children, I highly recommend it. It's not as good as Delicatessen, and there's more plot holes and things like that, but it's so damn entertaining and it's innovative. And I think that's what I love so much about Delicatessen is that it's just weird, but it's not just weird for the sake of being weird. There's a very good story and there's a very good message to all of this, but it's done in the way of a stage play slash circus slash just there's just something so amusing about the entire thing, even down to the part of a lady's about to try to kill herself and she's using every single situation imaginable for suicide and she still fails. And while that should be a dark scene in this dark movie, you still find yourself going, you know what? That's pretty ridiculous. And he just came up with a Rube Goldberg of failed suicide.
And that honestly was one of the things that really caught me off guard in this movie, because I mean, normally like depictions of suicide have a triggering effect on me when it comes to seeing them in film and stuff, especially when they are taken so lightheartedly as it is in this film. But it is just portrayed in such a way where it's just this Rube Goldberg machine. So it's entertaining to watch and see what she's concocted next to try to get it to work. And then just to see it continuously fail, it's like, wow. It's really hard to put words to it because it is such a, it's such a dire topic to talk about. And it's just presented in such a way where it does come off lighthearted despite being so dark and so grim.
That's how a lot of this movie does. I mean, this movie is about cannibalism. This movie is about a apartment complex full of cannibals because the only meat they can get is human flesh. And this guy who runs the deli, he kills somebody for that. He brings in a new person to fix up the apartment under the guise that they're going to do whatever. And he's made a deal with everybody. He's going to kill him. I mean, one of the darkest but funniest moments of this movie is when the woman and her husband are walking out and she says, I just wish I could say goodbye. And he said, well, you'll get to now, as she's carrying a hunk of meat from her dead mother. I mean, it's so grotesque and it shouldn't work. And yet you can't stop smiling at how over the top it all is, because down to that, just that fun opening scene of what is this guy doing? He's got himself wrapped in newspapers. He's peeking through. He's going to get in a garbage can. He's going to escape. What's going on? And it ends with him being chopped. And then we see them giving out the meat, and it's like, are they eating him? Is that what's really happening here? And here comes Dominic Pignon, who is one of the funniest looking guys in movies. And I mean that with as much respect as possible, but he just fits this role so perfectly because he is a clown. He is a clown. Yeah. And I mean, I just love that transition of, oh my God. And here comes their next person. And for us to know that the entire movie, and he doesn't know that. There's something so damn amusing about that, and it just leads to this wackiness throughout.
Yeah, and I mean, it's a really great use of dramatic irony, where we as the audience know what's going on in this world, and we even have people trying to tell him what's going on in this world, because Julie literally tries to tell him in that hilarious tea party scene, and he just doesn't know what's going on. He just doesn't get it. And we see the dread. We see the doom. We know it's not a matter of if he's going to mess up and be in the hallway at night at one point. It's when it's going to happen. And it's just that anticipation keeps you going throughout the film. And it's just infused with these incredible characters in this incredible setting, which is brilliantly set up in the opening 2 minutes of this film. And they don't even have to tell you anything else about the world. All you need to know is that it's bad enough people are eating people, and they're using lentils as currency.
How much more do you need to know other than that? And what I find fascinating about how this movie goes on is you never lose sight of any of the characters. And to me, this is his first feature length film. You're an auteur making this weird ass movie, and it's your first one, and you have all these things going on. You got the troglodytes, you got the butcher, you got the mailman, you have Stan, I guess his name is. It's like a Stan and Ollie type thing, but it's Stan and Livingstone. I mean, Livingstone coming out as a monkey. It's hilarious. You have the wife or whatever, the mistress, whatever she is. You have the daughter, you have the family with the two kids, and grandma's there, and you can tell everybody wants to kill grandma because they need the food. You have the guy who's in the basement with all the amphibians. You have the two guys making those weird toys that make the noises, and who ends up getting his leg chopped off. You have all of these moving parts, and as this movie is reaching its climax, it never once lets up. It you don't lose track of who these people are. It just keeps going. And I think that's such an incredibly difficult thing to pull off in a movie like this, because we should surely lose somebody. And we don't. We don't lose anybody. Everybody kind of gets their moment at the end, and we get some sort of conclusion to what their story and what their character was.
Yeah, and it despite the fact that there's so much focus on our two main characters of Stan and Julie, it really does come across as an ensemble piece still, where each of these characters, no matter how minor they are, do seem to play a pivotal role into what's happening in the film and into the overall picture of the film.
And I think that's definitely a style of Genet, because Genet, even Amelie, which is about Amelie, it's very much about all of the characters around Amelie. And then you also have A Very Long Engagement, which is very much about Audrey Tautou's character. But it's going, you know, all the other characters are very big players, and he's kind of like a Wes Anderson type. All of these characters in these, if you haven't seen The City of Lost Children, if you haven't seen Amelie, if you haven't seen A Very Long Engagement, they're all in these movies. Rufus and Tiki Helgado and the guy who plays the mailman, he's in Amelie. He's got a great role in that. The butcher is in everything. Like, they're all in everything that he does, which to me just signals he must be so much freaking fun to work with. Dominic Pignon is in everything, and his role's in everything. Like, it's almost like he starts off writing a role for that guy, and then he says, okay, now let me actually write the story, because his City of Lost Children role is ridiculous. His role in Amelie, he plays one of the biggest creeps of all time, but it all just works. And I don't think that Genet has a circus background, but I do think that Genet grew up admiring the circus and probably the works of Fellini and such, because he very much wants to make these circus type ensembles where you have your clowns and you have your acrobats and you have all of these different people. It's not just and even your normal characters can't just be normal. The daughter can't just be normal. She has to be ashamed that she's blind to the point where she's knocking things over and she always buys two of everything because she breaks everything. Like all of those little characterizations, those things get passed over nowadays in comedy. You know, and that's something, you know, we talked about Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri last week. What makes movies like this resonate, these dark black comedies, is that you feel like you know everyone. And that's so hugely important.
Yeah, especially when we're dealing with a situation that's so, not even bizarre, but so dark. Because we are dealing with a post-apocalyptic world where they are resorted to eating other humans and tricking humans to come work at this apartment complex so that they can eat them. So it's really important to contrast that in this. If you're not leading completely into that aspect of the genre, you need to present a foil to it in the characters, because you need that lightheartedness there to make it so everyone doesn't leave the film incredibly depressed.
Yeah, and I don't leave this film depressed in any way, shape, or form. And what he's good at, too, is he has some very beautiful moments. I mean, think about the scene where I can't think of his actual name in the movie. I think it's Stan. But Stan, he's doing the bubbles for the kids as they're sitting there after he first comes in. And that's how he first meets the daughter. And that's why she's instantly attracted to him. And this is a very beautifully designed shot and the sequence and everything. It's all very well done. And it's done in this beautiful meet cute type way, but this guy's so weird and so is she. And I mean, even down to like, why is there an entire scene? And is this just in Jhené? This is a trope for him, which is so freaking bizarre because this exact same thing almost happens in Amelie. But why do we have an entire scene of them having sex, but we only see the springs and everybody's doing it in beat, hitting off their carpet, playing the cello, whatever they're doing, they're all doing it. Why? Like, why are we watching Stan go back and forth with the roller on the ceiling? Boom, 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 boom. Why is that happening? And I think that there's a beauty to what he was doing with this to take your mind off the fact that these are cannibals. These are desperate people that we normally wouldn't appreciate, and yet we're doing so.
Yeah, and by giving these like mundane tasks to these people, like during that sex scene, which is beautiful because as it just cuts between the springs and the painting and the banging and the drilling and the cello, it just makes everything seem normal. Mm-hmm. If you had someone walk in the middle of this movie, they're not going to know what's going on.
No.
They're not going to realize that it's this post-apocalyptic movie where everyone's waiting just to eat this one character. They're just going to think it's this quirky apartment complex movie where there's a bunch of quirky neighbors and everything. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what this film does so well, is it contains itself well. We're in this apartment and we're getting to know these characters, but it's not over-exaggerating the influences of the outside world on these characters to the point where it becomes overbearing.
Yeah, I totally agree, because despite the fact that there's a message to this movie, you know, the fact that, okay, post-apocalyptic, how desperate will human beings get? What will human beings stoop to in desperate times? It doesn't hit you over the head with anything, and that's okay. It's allowing you to tune out. And you know, you say coming in the middle of a movie, imagine you walk into this movie and it's the scene where he's trying to figure out which spring is squeaking. And he's just ba-doom, ba-doom, ba-doom. And it's musical, though. There's a rhythm to this movie. There's a music to this movie that, you know, we'll talk about Trainspotting with its amazing soundtrack. Delicatessen creates its own soundtrack. We talk about it with the sex scene. You talk about it with this scene where he's fixing the spring. You have it where they're doing the tika tika dance or whatever it's called, the tika tika walk. I mean, there's a music to this, and I don't know. Obviously, he could get away with a lot of this because it's funding and it's the first movie and all of that, and there's not a big chance taken on this. It's a very contained movie, but. There's so much to this movie that is like poetic. That's not even in the lyrics. That's not even in the words. That's not in any of that. It's just in the design of what he's doing.
Absolutely. And it comes down to the use of color palette as well in this film, where the hallways are all grungy, dark, you know, those dark browns and everything. And then the apartments are a lot more colorful and they have a lot more character in them. This delicatessen guy takes this, takes our main character up into his apartment, and it's huge. I'm just thinking, how is there this much floor space in a post-apocalypse?
And it's because everybody has, they don't allow more people in. Nobody else is allowed in. That's why he has so much floor space, because there's nobody else allowed into that apartment complex. They eat them. That's it. And so that room stays open for whoever it's going to be. And then they eat them. And the coloring of a Genet movie, like I always think it's funny because going to film school, working in film, Jordan Alford, you can watch it on Amazon Prime. It's on Amazon Prime. You know, working in film school, going and working in film, everybody always wants to talk about the French New Wave and all of that stuff. To me, if you want to start teaching students, hey, I want to teach you this. I want to teach you a class about French film or about international film. I feel like Genet is actually a pretty good starting point for this kind of thing, because he's not really old. In terms of, you know, you're not watching black and white and weird cuts. I mean, I love Breathless as much as the next person, but, you know, it is what it is. But he's also weird enough that you know you're not watching an American film as you're watching it. And I think that's so important because, like, when you're trying to introduce people to other movies where it's subtitles or whatever, if they start watching a movie that they feel like they could just watch in English, they're not going to watch it. They're not going to be intrigued by it. But this is the type of guy who everything he does, he's an artist. And I think that's the difference. It can only be done by him, and it has to be done in this weird French way. And City of Lost Children has a very similar color design. Amelie, very similar, but with all the greens and reds and blues and, like, you know, but still very light and soft. And even though this movie is dark, think about Seven, how dark that movie is. It's pitch black. You know, there's scenes where, like, maybe the guy, I always think of Gluttony, where he's laying on the table and everything around him is black and gross and dirty. This movie is dirty and gross and all that. But for the most part, it's actually soft lighting. You don't feel like you're walking into the monster in the closet here. You feel like you're just walking into kind of like almost a dream world. And I think it's really fascinating the way you can make the colors feel like you're in a dream as opposed to being in this reality of absolute darkness.
Even if we look at the sewer scene, where there is a bit of darkness used to you know, artistically show the walking down the sewer at first, but when we get to the point where we are with the troglodytes and they're in this, they're just seeped in yellows and browns and like the sepia tones that we are very used to seeing in post-apocalyptic movies nowadays, but there's still color in those scenes. It's not like it's dark and gritty and there's just this abundance of evil seeped into that scene with these people who, you know, have been set up previously in the film to be the bad guys in this situation. And they're still presented in a lot of light and as very genuine characters, despite the fact that we don't get to spend a lot of time with them.
Well, and you never, even when the daughter is walking down there, you never feel that she's going to be in danger. You always feel that whatever's going to happen. And I think when you're trying to balance tone, think about tone, how many movies miss tone, how they have like their really dark scene in a romantic comedy, or they have a comedic scene in a really dark movie. You're going, what the hell is this? Like, people miss tone all the time. You want to talk about nailing tone. This guy was able to create a scene where she's walking through these sewers going towards these evil people, as we've been told. And yet we never feel that something bad is going to happen to her, which is 100% intentional. We're not meant to feel that. This is not a miss of, oh, what's going to happen. It's the same thing as the scene where they're coming down the stairs. You know that Stan is not going to be the one who gets chopped up. But you hear the screaming and everything. You're just like, how is this going to get butchered? How is the grandma going to mess this up? Or how's the butcher going to mess this up? And ultimately it leads to the one brother getting his leg chopped off. But still, when that next scene starts of Stan with the thing in his head, you're like, oh my God, did they actually kill him? Because no part of you is saying they're going to kill this guy. And so that's how I think that that sewer scene is so perfectly nailed. Cause when all those guys jump out, you never feel for a second that she's in danger, but you're always intrigued by who the hell are these people and what are they doing? and how is this going to work out throughout the rest of this movie? And I think he does a brilliant job of not introducing this until the halfway point of the movie, because I think anything earlier and it starts to get a little cluttered. We need to know all of these characters first before getting into these just total weirdos.
Yeah, and these total weirdos help to stir up this excitement in the final act too, where they're just messing up everything.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, and I love how they mess up everything, but they also play into some of this stuff when they get there and she opens up the trash chute and she goes to throw it down and the guy's face is right there and she starts flipping out and everything. And then when the husband comes in, the troglodyte's not there anymore. It's like, okay. Like they still think she's crazy and it's just the people in the pipes talking to her. Or, you know, there's so many moments like that throughout. And obviously the one little moment where he goes back, they capture the wrong girl. Is that a male? I don't know. Like, I guess we'll have to check. And then he comes back and he kisses her just in case I don't come back. It's just like this totally bizarre, over the top. And it never lets up from the opening scene until the very last, where they're playing the musical Saw and the cello on the roof, and they make it seem like the boys are playing it. This movie never once lets up with the stylistic choices that it makes.
No, absolutely not. And even speaking of the musical Saw, what a stylistic choice to make too, because he when we're introduced to the fact that he plays the Saw, he's just like, I play a musical instrument too. Like, okay. And he goes, gets it, and it's a Saw, and you're like, what? And then he actually demonstrates playing the Saw, and you understand how it's musical then. And then, but then he also explains that he had this act that he did with Livingstone, where Livingstone played the cello and he played the Saw. And then you wonder how a chimp played the cello.
Yeah, exactly. And I love that Livingstone is a chimp, because that makes it absolutely hilarious. Yeah, I don't know. It just all works from top to bottom. And like when it's revealed that Livingstone is a chimp, and this whole time they think it's an act and all of that, and then it just ends up being that, it's just so out of left field. It's just so out of left field. And I don't know. I the musical Saw was so, it's so weird. And you're like, all right, is he just doing this through this? But then he makes it beautiful. He makes it sound so unique and everything, that you're like, there's an emotion to this. And I started thinking, is this what they used in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest to create the score for that movie? Were they using a musical Saw? Because it starts to sound like the score from One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And who knows? But like, it's something that just seems like it's going to be outrageous, and it's not. And I think that that happens a lot in this movie, where pretty much everybody, even when they're doing the most outlandish things, they kind of have a purpose to it.
Yeah, absolutely. And it all just culminates in this fantastic, essentially chase scene where they're being chased through the apartment, and then he starts ripping apart all the plumbing to flood the bathroom so that it surges out at them and they have a chance to escape. And then you have the amphibian guy from the basement with all his frogs running free, and he's talking about how they have their opportunity to be free now and everything. It's just, it's so funny.
Yeah. What I think is fascinating about this is, like, Guillermo del Toro watched this movie. Guillermo del Toro has seen this movie and has appreciated this movie, and you can see it in The Shape of Water. You know, the scene where they fill up the room in The Shape of Water and all of that, it's very much taken from this. Now, that's not like a completely unique idea, but it's very clear with the way it's designed and the way it's filmed and all of that, that there was a lot of inspiration there. I mean, even down to some of the more grotesque scenes in The Shape of Water, there's a lot of inspiration there. Now, I think Del Toro was coming out with his first movies around the same time that Genet was coming out with his first movies. The difference is Genet never hit the mainstream. Genet did Alien Resurrection. It's not very good. That was his really old, that was his, I believe, his only American film. He followed it up with Amelie, which everybody was a fan of. He followed it up with A Very Long Engagement, which was almost a hit. It wasn't quite a hit, but it was almost there. And then he really fell off after that. And I think, though, that people just, they don't realize how much he inspired some of their favorite movies or some of their favorite scenes moving forward. I mean, you can see even Dark City. You can tell that with Dark City. And if you watch The City of Lost Children, you'll see it as well. Alex Proyas takes a lot of inspiration from this guy. I would be floored if Alex Proyas had not watched these movies. I'd be floored.
No, so, absolutely. And that is one of the nice things about going through some of these more auteur movies as we're viewing more movies and everything, is because when you go back and see some of these movies, you start seeing the inspirations people have. right? Like, I mean, in a very long time, we'll talk about Battleship Potemkin, and we're going to be talking, let's be honest, we'll probably talk like 20 minutes about the Odessa steppe scene, because that's the most important scene in that entire movie, and one of the most important scenes in film history. And there are so many people out there who have seen that scene replicated in dozens of films and have no idea. That's the thing.
Yeah.
And that's one of the great things about film, is you get to see those influences. So we get to see the influence that Delicatessen has on all the films that have come after it.
Yep. Yeah. And it's a movie that you hadn't even heard of, and that most people haven't heard of unless they're a diehard Jeanne fan. And what's funny is I had seen two Jeanne movies. Or I'd seen three, because I'd seen Alien Resurrection. One of them is number four on my list, and the other one is somewhere in like the 50s or something along those lines. And then I just never bothered to watch Delicatessen and City of Lost Children. Delicatessen is going to be my top 100 when I eventually make another top 100. This is a movie that I watched the first time after we had already started this list and all of those. And but this is going to be in my top 100. I love this movie. I think it's hilarious. I love every element of it. I could say that from the four movies of Jeanne's that I think are masterpieces, or three of them are masterpieces and one of them is close. It just has more plot holes. But if you can look past those, because it's essentially just a fantasy movie, this probably is my second favorite director behind Kubrick. And that's not a crazy overstatement. This is a guy who, I'd have three of his movies in my top 100 had I seen this in time. And I thoroughly enjoy a fourth movie from him. How many other directors can you really say that about? I mean, even if you just look at your own top 100, you know, like, this is to anybody out there.
Yeah.
Can you really say that? And I think the answer is no. And I just love his style. I love the way he does things. And do I overrate Amelie? Probably. But so what? You probably overrate something that I don't like. So this movie, to me, it's dark, it's perfect, and it's what ultimately leads to his greatest success and one of the greatest movies ever made, which is Amelie. So. There you go. That's how I feel about that. All right, John, you have anything else you want to say about Delicatessen, or do we go on?
Let's move on.
All right. Well, first let's do what was the best thing you watched this week? John, what do you got for me?
Well, I watched a couple of movies for my top 100 this week, so I'm not going to count those. The best new movie I saw this week was by far Wages of Fear.
Never seen it. It's on my list.
Yeah, it'd been on my list for quite a while. I finally got around to watching it. And boy, I don't think I've ever seen a more stressful film. For those of you that don't know the film, what year was it? I think it's 52.
53.
And it's about these four men in South America who have to transport two trucks full of nitroglycerin improperly across the dangerous road. And from the moment that truck gets loaded up with nitroglycerin to the end of the film, you are on the edge of your seat, because you know at any moment these people can just blow up and it can all be over.
And that is one, John, that has been on my list for pretty much as long as Delicatessen was on my list.
It was an incredible film. Highly recommend it. It's on Canopy.
It's also on HBO Max for anybody who has HBO Max. It is on there as well. Yes. And he's also, Clouzot is the guy who directed, Diabolique, or I can never know how to say it, but the movie that inspired Psycho. So there you go. I did not watch that. I actually didn't watch much this week. I had a pretty busy week. I was kind of like off center, all week. So I will say the best movie I watched this week was Pompoko, which is Studio Ghibli. Not as good as what I watched last week, which was I had Man Bites Dog, I think, one week. I don't think that was last week, but maybe that was the week before. But anyway, I really liked Pompoko. Was very entertaining, a little weird. And I'm going to say a bad word here, so everybody, you know, who's tuning in, who's sensitive, don't listen. And mom, I'm sorry, but weird that there's a lot of raccoon scrotum in this movie. But aside from that, really good movie. I love the narration. It's very blatant that Wes Anderson wanted to make Isle of Dogs this movie. I think Isle of Dogs is one of Wes Anderson's biggest failures. I didn't laugh once. I didn't find it even a bit interesting, but the straightforward narration is very similar to what we see in Pompoko. And I think Pompoko did it in a more interesting way. And it's kind of unfortunate that in the American dubbing, they call them raccoons, because in reality, they're not actually raccoons. They're like Tinkuri or Tinaka. I don't actually know how to pronounce it, but there's something else. And I think that kind of loses a bit of the mysticism of them, because it's a big thing in Japanese culture, and calling it raccoons kind of makes it seem like, oh, it's just like a garbage eater. Mm-hmm. But that's not really what it is. So if you're into raccoon scrotum, this is the movie for you. That's really all I got about that. They call it pouches in the American version. Thank God. But anyway, good movie. One of the better Studio Ghiblis, which, by the way, I'm working my way through them in order, and I haven't watched in a while. My favorite still so far is Porco Rosso, and I haven't gotten a Princess Mononoke or Spirited Away or any of that, but Porco Rosso is my movie right now, and I freaking loved it, and nobody ever talks about it. And I've actually found that I've enjoyed the Studio Ghibli movies that people haven't really talked about from those early ones more than I've enjoyed the ones that people are always praising, like My Neighbor Totoro, which I could, you know, pretty much throw in a garbage can and burn the garbage can and shoot it into outer space. And hopefully in space it would combust or something, because nobody needs to watch that movie. And if you tell me that's good, I get it, but I don't get it. But anyway, that's just a side note, and hopefully that'll get Jordan Alford going over there in the chat. But John, let's move on to Trainspotting. Why Trainspotting?
Who needs a reason when you have heroin?
Dude, I'm telling you.
honestly, this is a movie. It's been a while since I've seen it, but I remembered thoroughly enjoying it. And I did sit there watching it again this week, being like, oh my God, yes, I very much remember why I put this movie in my top 100. Mm-hmm. And Danny Boyle's approach to addiction and getting out of addiction in this film is so incredible. This is a very 90s movie, but it still remains so relevant. And it's sometimes hard to believe that they actually made a sequel to this movie.
Yeah, I don't know why. That was in 2017. I never saw it. I never really had an interest.
No, neither did I. I had no idea. When they announced it, I was like, that's a strange choice to make. Didn't think it was necessary. But in the end, the characters of Renton and Spud and
Bagby
and Sick the other Boy. One, Sick Boy, that's it, are incredibly fun characters to watch. And seeing them try to succeed and then fail and try to succeed, and ultimately we do eventually see Renton get to the point where he is succeeding by making so the rest of his friends don't succeed. It just feels so potent for not only a tale of addiction, but also just like the struggle of realization and of making yourself better.
Yeah, so I think this movie is the cocaine version of a heroin addiction movie. Does that make sense? Like, this is the high pace, whatever. And 4 years later, Darren Aronofsky comes out with my preferred version of this, which is Requiem for a Dream. Requiem for a Dream is the ultra depressing. There's no good music in it. It's the symphonies and it's the quartet. I forget the name of the quartet that did all the music for the movie, but masterful soundtrack or masterful score, whatever. But this is like the lighthearted version of heroin addiction. Now, you still have Tommy, which I can't even watch that stuff because, you know, Kevin McKidd's character in that is absolutely brutal. And again, like, I come from an area where there's been a heroin problem, and that, you know, that's been something that obviously bothers me, because a lot of those people start out like Tommy and then they just tried it once and look what happens. Now, obviously, they're going to go to the extreme with this in this movie because he's the only one who you could possibly give a shit about. But this is the cocaine version. This is the high paced. What are we going to do? We're going to dance. We're going to sing. We're going to play punk rock all the time. And that's what we're going to do. And then you look at Requiem 4 years later, a completely different approach to the exact same topic. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of just your preference. I prefer Requiem because, you know, I'm all about that just style. That used to be very high in my top 100. And then I just moved it completely off because it's too damn depressing. But Trainspotting does a great job of balancing how dark it is with keeping it light enough that you want to keep watching without ever diminishing the fact that this is a terrible, terrible thing they're all dealing with.
Yeah, and I mean, Jordan Alford made a really good point where this is the movie that makes it so you don't want to take drugs, because despite the fact that it is kind of more lighthearted and it is a little more fun, mm-hmm. it shows the horrifying side of drugs and what it does to people. I mean, I don't think there's any better analogy to addiction than putting your hands into a toilet that you just defecated in to get the suppositories of heroin that fell out of your ass.
Yes, exactly. And I think the problem with this one is this one's more relatable, because mm-hmm. this is just a bunch of friends hanging out being drug addicts. That's different than, you know, Requiem is more about like, oh, we're going to become drug addicts and we're going to sell it and we're going to do all this stuff and blah, blah, blah. It's like a get rich quick thing. This movie is just a bunch of friends and they're doing this good time thing that you could see yourself doing with your friends. They go out to clubs and they party. They go to try to pick up girls. They go and they, you know, they're trying not to work too. They don't want to work. You know, they're trying to blow the interview on purpose and they're living off the man and whatever. Like, these are things that you could see yourself doing much more easily than with Requiem. And I think what's also ultra disturbing about this movie is all of the music is very upbeat. And mm-hmm. even Perfect Day, which is not upbeat at all, the Lou Reed song that plays, mm-hmm. it's still playing in a way that makes it feel as though there's still beauty to this whole entire thing. It's really fascinating, the decisions that were made here, but it does that balance of, oh my God, I never want to be these guys, because it still gets into the horrors. I mean, the finally when they have had it, when the parents have had enough and they say, we're going to lock you in this room and now you're going to go through withdrawals. It's a hell of a way to film that, because it's not quite The Fighter when Christian Bale is going through his heroin withdrawals, but this is definitely probably what it's like to go through withdrawals and that just that fear the entire time. It's so well done.
I also think that scene's absolutely brilliant. Mm-hmm. I think every aspect of it is great, where it's going by so quickly that you're just really confused the entire time. It's terrifying. That baby crawling across the ceiling, mm-hmm. maybe one of the most terrifying scenes ever made, ever in any type of film.
It's just coming for him. It's over. Yeah.
And then just the scene goes just a little too long. It feels like it goes just a little too long, which, you know, is completely intentional mm-hmm. to push home the fact that, like, it's going to seem like this is going on forever, but it's only just beginning.
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing is, you're sitting there going, okay, is when's he going to go back on it? When's it going to happen again? You know, what's going to happen here? And I mean, there's some crazy stuff in that scene for the withdrawal and all of that. And you can see, like, with the screaming and stuff, I actually had to turn it down here in my apartment complex, because it's like, that kind of just sounds like a man screaming. You know, Ewan McGregor is phenomenal in this movie. And you clearly see why he became a star very quickly after all of this. Cause he was good looking, even though he looked like a drug addict in this movie and all of that. But, you know, that scene, I mean, it's brutal. And I think that's the thing with this movie is, like, do I need to watch him dive into that world's most disgusting toilet? No, I don't need to watch that. It's brutal. It's awful. Like, it's just nasty. But there's also parts of this where I'm like, that's disgusting, but I can't stop looking. When he shoots up and he goes into the and he's overdosing. I mean, that is so well done. And you're looking at that needle and, like, he's going to put this in his arm. Like, he's going to put that brown looking gunk, whatever, that, like, that clearly is not clean. And he's going to put that in his arm anyway, because that's how much he needs this fix. You know, there's just some really disgusting moments in this movie that are made, again, kind of like with Delicatessen, to seem beautiful, even though they absolutely are not.
Yeah, absolutely. Even if we go back to the worst toilet in all Scotland, the diving in, and then, like, there's that very beautiful scene of him. You see him crawling into the toilet and you're like, that is the most disgusting thing in the world. And then it's just this, like beautiful blue water that he's just swimming through to find the suppositories. And he climbs back out and you're like, okay, that's weird. I guess that's like a heroin thing. Mm-hmm. And then he gets home and he's soaking wet.
Yeah.
And you're just like, wait, what? How did this happen? And, like, it's those little decisions sometimes that really help elevate a film like this.
Yeah, it makes you wonder, is he actually soaking wet, or is he sweating like that because of the withdrawals? You know what I mean? Because that's something, when people are going through withdrawals, they're sweating like crazy on that. And so is that something that's happening to him? Because he was already saying he was in desperate need of a fix, and now he really needs a fix. Mother Superior's whole apartment, everything that goes on in there is just like, you know, that's really, you know, clearly this is what it's like, you know what I mean? Like, that's really how it is. And it's just a bunch of people sitting around, and Mother Superior doesn't even mess with the stuff, because he's just sitting there making sure everybody else is getting high. And even when he realizes, like, hey, you shouldn't be here, it doesn't matter to him. And I always think, you know, clearly a lot of the, you know, heroin culture comes from, but they praise Lou Reed and the Velvet Underground and all of that. And Lou Reed has the song Street Hassle, where he talks about grabbing your old lady by the feet, dragging her out in the darkened street, and by the morning, she's just another hit and run. Mm-hmm. Well, that is essentially what Mother Superior is doing with Ewan McGregor. He's probably, like, he's literally dragging him out while he's unconscious, saying, I guess we should call you a cab. Calling him a cab, not calling him an ambulance, because he's not having his shit get messed up. And so he's going to call him a cab and just be like, hopefully he doesn't die so he can keep coming back and giving me money. I don't give a shit otherwise, though, if this person lives or dies. And so, like, there's so many, like, clear markers of just, like, you know, that drug culture of, as long as I don't get in trouble, I don't care what happens to him or anything like that. Like, there's just so many, I can't even think of the word, but it's just very accurate is I guess what I'm trying to say.
And one of the nice things about this film, I love the inclusion of Begbie's character as someone who's clean, but still has an addiction.
Yeah.
And it's very clear that this movie is not just about drugs. It's about addiction as a whole, because Robert Carlyle's phenomenal in this film.
Yeah. Robert Carlyle is so good.
So fantastic as Begbie. And just to see, he has this, even when they're first introducing him and describing him, he has this urge in his body just to fight all the time, and it never ends well. But Robert Carlyle just presents it in such a way. And when he's telling the pool story, and then Tommy afterwards is like, it wasn't like that at all, and it just shows the length of the addiction and the lies that go to cover the addiction.
Well, yeah, and I think, you know, that's kind of how a lot of this movie is. It's, you know, yeah, the heroin addicts are the ones who are front and center, but that there's addictions all over the place, and that just because Robert Carlyle's not addicted, Begbie's not addicted to heroin, he's still got his problems, and that he's no better than these other guys he's hanging out with. It's very much one of those movies that's like, you know, the company you keep. If Tommy doesn't hang around these guys when he's clearly better than all these guys, they don't steal his sex tape, his girlfriend doesn't break up with him, and he doesn't end up becoming the drug addict who dies of HIV. Or AIDS, like, or whatever he actually ends up dying of, the blood clot or whatever that comes from the cat poop. Yeah. Like, he doesn't end up dying of that if it's not from the company he keeps. And I think that's very much what this movie, you know, at the beginning when it's saying choose life, choose a job, choose a wife, choose whatever. It's very much saying, like, that's the company of you. That's you, the audience watching this. That's what you do. That's not what we do. It's not just, that's not what Renton does. That's not what we do in general.
Yeah.
And so I think that that's what this movie is more about, is like, there might be different variations of addicts, but, you know, who are you really keeping yourself around? Because you're just going to keep bringing yourself down. I mean, when they're like, hey, we want to sell the drugs, can you do one more hit? Or there's a last hit and there's a last hit. This was a last hit. You don't even know what the hell he's saying, but he goes and he takes the hit anyway, because the friends don't give a shit that he's clean. They want their money.
Yeah. Yeah, no, exactly. And when you're looking into some of these other aspects of it, they're talking about the trivialities of life, essentially, you know, the have a wife, have a job, pay rent, these things, and how none of it matters when you're on drugs. And then it's then mirrored at the end, where all you have Renton is spewing off all of these things that he's going to do now that he's off drugs, and it's all these trivial things. It's nothing exciting. It's not like he's going to go see the world or anything. He's just talking about getting a job and paying rent and having a family and things like that.
He's going to be just like us. That's what he said. I'm going to be just like you, is what he says. You know, And it's true, because those are the things you always think about when you're growing up. Oh, how am I going to get myself to that position? How am I going to get myself there? I want to get to the point where I have the money, I have whatever. And when you're on drugs, like, yeah, you don't care. You don't care at all that any of that stuff's going on around you. I mean, yeah, there's this other stuff. I mean, when Tommy says, let's go for a hike, we live in Scotland, like, let's go do this. And they're just like, no, like, we're just not going to do that. It's brutal. It's devastating, because you realize how, like, Tommy is right. Like, let's go enjoy the fact of where we live and all of that. And they just can't do it.
But at the same time, Renton's repose to that is so incredible. Just like, I don't hate the English. They're just a bunch of wankers. But we were colonized by a bunch of wankers. We're not even good enough to be colonized by a decent culture. And no amount of fresh air is going to help that. And like, that just summarizes the Scottish nationality so well. And just like any member of the Commonwealth, really. And it's, yes, they should go out and do hiking and get some fresh air and stuff. But at the same time, they're, as we were talking about trivialities before, they're just like, why do I bother with this triviality or these trivial things when it's not going to change anything?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's that chip on the shoulder. And if you look at where heroin has kind of sprung up in recent years, at least around America, and I don't know if it's really sprung up in Canada much or not, but in America, like, you know, it's been in small town, Kentucky, small town, New Jersey, small town, you know, Ohio. It's all these small towns, but that are also in states that are close enough to cities. Like Kentucky, you might not think, oh, well, Louisville's not that big. Lexington's not that big. Kentucky borders Cincinnati. You literally walk across a bridge and you're in Cincinnati, Ohio. All these areas that kind of feel like they're the afterthought. And that's kind of what Scotland is. Scotland's the afterthought. People don't really know. Is that a country? Is it not a country? Like, what is it? What is Scotland? You don't really know if you don't live in Scotland or if you're not like in Europe constantly keeping track. I mean, it's hard enough to keep track of, you know, well, no, it's not that hard to keep track, but it's like, who's in the European Union? Who's not? Where does your money actually work if you just have the pound? Or where does your money work if you have the euro? Like, what's going on? You know, if you're not there all the time, you don't really know. And so I think it's a good depiction of, you know, the chip on your shoulder of living in one of those places that doesn't really have its own identity. And I think that's when drug addiction and drugs do start to come out a lot, is there's really nothing else to do. And there's nowhere, like, we don't have any like respect for ourselves. So how can we ever try to achieve something greater? Screw it. Let's just get high and let's go do drugs and let's go to the club. And one of the most brilliant decisions in this entire movie, do not give an age to the person, because we don't know how old Kelly McDonald is. So you can take in your mind, yes, she's still in grammar school or whatever the hell, she's not in grammar school, but she's in high school, whatever you would call it. And we don't actually know how old she is, because if you give her an age, it's suddenly not funny once you start to go forward with it. So it still can get away with it, because we're like, oh, she's just 16. You know, like, that's legal in some places. Like, who the hell knows? But it's not funny if you actually give her an age, because we don't know what her age is. But again, just going out and partying with whoever the hell is willing to party with us. That's really what it comes down to, because you just don't have the respect for yourself.
Yeah. And that whole sequence with Diane is actually quite funny, despite the fact that you find out that it's not a very funny situation. And Renton's not treating it like a funny situation. He's pissed. He is pissed. He's like, oh my God, this is illegal. Like, I can go to jail. My life could be completely ruined. And
which is hilarious, because the whole movie he's shooting heroin.
Yeah, exactly. It's just like these different levels of things that can impact your life. And even when we get to the point where him and Spud are arrested after they shoplift, and Spud's given 6 months in jail, and Renton's said, hey, go to this program. I mean, it really goes to show how little the justice system cares about addicts. Because, in all honesty, which one of those two is probably more likely to get off drugs at that point? Probably the one in prison who's going to have a harder time getting drugs.
Yeah. Well, and that's what always ends up happening. I mean, that's like one of the biggest reasons why it won't end, is because people know where all of the houses are, all the addiction homes are. And then they know where to go. And now you're actually, and like, it's, you know, it's a negative way to look at it, obviously, because there are very positive stories that probably come out of this, but it's now you're putting all the drug addicts, the former drug addicts together. Mm-hmm. And then when they leave, they don't really know where to turn because they haven't, it's just one of those things. And it's true. Like, they don't really care. This justice system, they don't really care. The way they're looking at it is great. He's off the streets. And James Cosmo, who plays Renton's father, it's Jorah Mormont's dad from Game of Thrones. He's barely in this movie, but he has those little facial expressions the entire time. And the mother, I don't know who plays her, but it's like, this is probably what the parents are dealing with. And like, they thought, oh good, my son's going to do this. Cause you always hope that your kid is telling you the truth, that your family member is telling you the truth, that they're not going to screw you over, that they're not going to go behind your back and start doing it again. But an addiction's an addiction for a reason. Mm-hmm. It's an addiction for a reason. And no matter what the addiction is to, it's an addiction for a reason. And that's why Renton goes immediately back. And then they just say, screw it, we're locking you in a room.
Well, and that's also part of why it's so brilliant for Danny Boyle to start the movie. And I mean, I know this is an adaptation based off a novel, but to start the film just with Renton saying he's going to go clean is really good, because then it does set up this point where it's like, okay, he wants to go clean. And then it really nails home how deep the addiction is, because he's talking about the one last hit. He gets the suppositories, and then we see him going for the suppositories. It's like, okay, like, he's pretty desperate for this. And then we see them all going back to heroin right away.
Yep.
And like that, it really does a good job of depicting addiction and how hard it is to kick addiction despite all your deepest desires to do so.
Yeah. And every time something bad happens to him, that's what they do. I mean, what is it? Allison's baby dies and then she shoots up.
Yep.
And Renton just cooks for her and then she shoots up. It's brutal. And I wonder if Allison is named Allison because of Slow Dive, because that is very much of the music. Just throwing that out there. If you haven't listened to Allison by Slow Dive, go listen to that. It's like one of the greatest songs ever. It's shoegaze, but it very fits with this music. And maybe instead of putting the song in, they were just like, let's just like shoegaze. But anyway, yeah, like that's what they do. Anytime something bad happens, it's just, let's shoot heroin and let's just like go unconscious and forget that anything's ever happening. Because again, going back to the whole Lou Reed thing, if you listen to Heroin by the Velvet Underground, that whole song, I mean, it's an ode to heroin. And it's like, you know, when there's a main line in my vein, things aren't quite the same. Like, it's just all this stuff about how great heroin is and how great you feel on it. And that's what this movie is saying. And every time they pass out, it's like, thank God I'm back to being passed out. It's the best thing in the world. And we get the negative of all of it, but like Sick Boy and Spud don't really, I mean, Sick Boy has the baby dying, Spud goes to jail briefly, but Sick Boy and Spud don't really have the negativity that obviously we see Renton have and that Tommy goes through because of, you know, actually dying.
Yeah. And speaking of Tommy's death, it's really interesting how Tommy's death kind of brings Renton back into it, because he did get out at that point. Because like after the detox scene, He becomes a realtor of some sort.
Yeah, and he goes up and he's selling crap. He's a terrible guy. Yeah.
Yeah. And like, he isn't communicating with anyone, because we see the only person he's communicating with is Diane still, of all people, who's then telling him vaguely what Spud said, because Spud's really hard to understand.
Yeah, Spud's really hard to understand, but then she finds out that Begbie robbed a bank. Yeah. And it leads to this movie is loaded with phenomenal music scenes. But the music scene when Begbie shows up and they start playing Mile End by Pulp, it is just, I love that. I mean, anybody who hasn't actually listened to Pulp is like really, really good. And Jarvis, I can't think of his last name. Oh, that's bad. But anyway, Jarvis from Pulp, he actually does the voice in Fantastic Mr. Fox. And they say he wrote a bad song, Petey, and they all get mad at him because he's singing that song about the foxes or whatever. But that's him. And so they do Mile End. And if you look at the lyrics to Mile End, it is literally about this. Like, you can tell that song was blatantly the inspiration for what they wrote this scene as, because it's just, the lyrics are spot on and it is very much about, you know, his life, but it's still something that fits so well with the movie. And just that scene of Begbie totally coming in and throwing off his entire life again. I love it. I love every single second of it. And the music throughout, I mean, this is one of those movies where, you know, it's, you could watch I always think about the Dave Chappelle skit where he says everything looks better in slow motion. Mm-hmm. And then it's like, this is me taking a dump in regular time. And he's just sitting there and this is me in slow motion. He like launches off the toilet stuff. It's so stupid. But that's what I think about with like some movies like Wes Anderson, Danny Boyle, Quentin Tarantino. You throw a good soundtrack on it, you could shoot somebody, you know, stubbing their toe and laying on the ground for an hour and a half. And I would still find it mesmerizing because you found a way to do it. This movie does it often, you know, with Sing and Mile End and Perfect Day, nightclubbing. It just does a great job. And then obviously with Born Slippy at the very end of the movie, when he's actually stealing the money, it just, you're just like ready to go. But you know, it's amazing what can be pulled off with that and how many people just don't really use soundtracks. Yeah, get your cat under control, John.
Yeah,
but how many people don't use soundtracks to the best of their advantage because, you know, they'll throw in a song here and there, but like how it can really drive a movie. And I think what made Trainspotting so popular might have been the way that it used this soundtrack.
Absolutely. And especially this is a very Scottish film. Mm-hmm. And the music is very British in the soundtrack. And there's a lot of stuff that, while had its popularity in North America, wasn't as popular. So the fact that you can watch this movie and just be like, oh man, here's this Lou Reed and this Iggy Pop and Pulp, all bands that people our age have probably listened to at some point but didn't realize they were listening to. Mm-hmm. And this movie uses it in such a way where it shows, it helps to elevate the scenes even more. Mm-hmm. And that's what a good soundtrack does. That's what is like the examples that you gave, right? That's what a Wes Anderson and a Quentin Tarantino do. And a Danny Boyle does it in his other films as well. Mm-hmm. It's just, that's what a soundtrack's for. A soundtrack isn't just to put some popular music into a movie. It's to be part of the art of the film.
Yeah, and I think there's been so many times where I've watched a movie where there's a song I hate when I'm driving around in a car or something like that, but it plays at a part in a movie you go, oh shit, like that, they knew what they were doing there. Like, mm-hmm. And it adds to that scene, and then you think of that scene and you have a different view on the movie. I don't think it matters whether you like the songs that are playing or not. And like when you sit down and you watch some of these movies that are on Netflix now, or you watch like a Lifetime movie, which Netflix and Lifetime are different, but not too much different when you actually look at some of the really shitty movies Netflix has made. But when you actually look at this, I just like, there's so many times it'll be like, here's the popular song. And people are like, oh, I know that song. But this movie, I've heard most of these songs, but until I'd seen the movie, I didn't listen to a lot of them or like might not have known like exactly who sang them or anything like that. But even if I don't listen, I'm not going to go listen to Iggy Pop. I'm not going to, but it's still awesome. And it still works so well with what I'm actually watching that, like I said, what is it? Born Slippy or whatever it's called. Mm-hmm. That song at the end when he's stealing the money, like that is not the style of music I listen to at all. But yeah, you better believe I threw that on like four times in a row after this movie ended because I could just keep imagining that.
Yeah,
that's what the movie should be. It's not about what do we think that people want to hear. It's does this fit with what we're actually filming right now? American Hustle, a movie that I thought was very meh. The scene where they're all singing Why Delilah or whatever it's called. That was like the turning point in the movie for him. Like, oh, good. Now we're back. Now we're actually have a movie. The whole first hour, I was bored to tears. But the last hour from that moment on, it just changed the tone for me. And it was mainly because of that song. And I was like, oh, I can get into this. And yeah, Danny Boyle just does it absolutely phenomenally in this movie.
Yeah. No, I think Danny Boyle's really underappreciated. I know like Slumdog Millionaire won the Oscar and everything, which is crazy because that's probably his worst movie.
One of them. He started making a little, you know, trying to think of go ahead, but continue.
Yeah.
Steve Jobs and the Beach aren't very good.
Oh yes, that's right. I forgot about Steve Jobs.
He started doing Steve Jobs, the Beach yesterday. He started falling apart a little bit after 127 hours, but
Danny Boyle, when you go back to his earlier works, and it's really with Trainspotting, and yes, there was the Beach, but then he also had 28 Days Later and Sunshine afterwards.
Yeah.
But Sunshine, highly underrated science fiction movie. That's like three quarters of an almost perfect movie.
Yeah. Yeah. The ending's a little bizarre, but you know,
but his direction is so good and just so underappreciated for how raw it can be at times. And Trainspotting just does such a good job of showing that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would say that Trainspotting is probably, without a doubt, my favorite of his movies. But Jordan Alvord said the Coens do fantastic soundtracks too. Blood Simple, the same old song playing throughout that movie is just, it's so well done. But anyway, so this movie also introduced Kelly MacDonald. And I know we got to like wrap it up here, but I just want to make note of that. This is the first movie Kelly MacDonald was in. That's fascinating. A lot of times when you get that introducing whoever and like they're young and they're attractive and it is what it is, they never really hit the mainstream. And I'm so grateful that Kelly MacDonald did hit the mainstream because she has done some phenomenal roles. What's in the Satchel, Llewellyn, is just unbelievable. Yeah. And then she's great in Boardwalk Empire, even though her story is absolutely boring as all shit after season two. And obviously, like, she goes on to do the voice for Brave and things like that. Kelly MacDonald's a very, very, very good actor. And it's crazy that this is her first movie. And yet they knew to promote this movie with her as a part of like the cover and everything like that to be like, yeah, women are in this movie. And she's freaking good in it. Like, she is so good in it. And I think that's, you know, that's not something that, you know, you can always expect from this introducing this person, especially when you're up against a cast with Ewan McGregor, Robert Carlyle, Ewan Bremmer, Johnny Lee Miller, and what's his name? Kevin McKidd, who is awesome in Rome, if you haven't watched Rome. But yeah, anyway, that's what I got for that. I just wanted to throw that in there, John, but I'll let you get the last word in on Trainspotting before I tell everybody what we're doing next week.
Now I have to think of a last word for Trainspotting.
Good luck.
But the thing with Trainspotting is you have to go in watching it kind of knowing that you're going to see those disturbing scenes to really enjoy it. You have to know that you're going into a movie about heroin and addiction to fully appreciate exactly what Danny Boyle is doing in this film. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I agree with you, because this could definitely catch you off guard if you're not kind of aware of what's about to take place. I do agree with that. But sit back and enjoy the ride. It is a ride. And if you don't like needles, don't watch, because there are some gratuitous close-ups of needles in this movie.
Yes, there are.
But so that's Trainspotting and Delicatessen. Delicatessen is on Amazon Prime, and I think that's it. Trainspotting is on Paramount Plus, at least here in the States. I don't know where it is in Canada, John. I mean, is it anywhere?
No,
the Blu-ray you own. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So, all right. So next week we are actually going to be on Monday of next week. We are not going to be on Tuesday. We're going to be a little off kilter for the next couple weeks. I was giving John the rundown before this. It's going to be a chaotic couple weeks, but we'll get back to it at the end of June where everything starts to look a little bit normal. But next week we are going to be on Monday, and we are going to be going. John's movie is Sinister from 2012, minus 12 Angry Men from 1957, one of only two 50s movies I have on my entire freaking list. And that'll be number 83. So number 83 of our top 100 as we continue to make our way through. And having fun doing it, still having a really good time, just going to be changing it, putting it on a different night. And you guys will have to stay tuned because it's going to keep changing. But that's it. Go follow us over on Letterboxd, J Millsip, PWood43. If you're into Survivor and stuff, we're doing that series. So make sure to check that out. We're having a lot of fun with it. Ultimate Survivor series. And follow Twitter, Survivor Specialist, all of that. We do actually tweet out when we're doing the movie stuff, even though we're a Survivor thing, because you know what? Survivor still isn't on. So, but that's it. John and I have gone through 17 episodes of this. If you haven't seen them all, make sure to do it. And if you haven't watched the movies and that's why you haven't watched our podcast, go watch the movies. Then you'll watch the podcast and you'll know why we wanted to podcast about them in the first place. Anyway, Sinister from 2012 and 12 Angry Men from 1957. That'll be next Monday. Bye, everyone.